Anybody ready for a meeting? My name is Jeff, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the Navi Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with one or more years of sobriety tells his or her story. I give you Ken.
I'm Ken. I'm an alcoholic. I started coming into this room in October of 1987. And there are faces here that were there, that were here when we were here. It seemed like there. It was so long ago. Terry and I went through basic together in AA. That's what it felt like. We shared some sponsorship with folks and whatnot. And for the first 7 or 8 years that I was in AA, most of that time I lived exactly 1 mile from here in Brookhaven. And I didn't live in the house I'd owned in Brookhaven. I drank that up. I lived in the apartment that I could afford in Brookhaven at that time, which was okay. But 1 mile from here, so I was here most days for the 5:45, every day for the 8 o'clock, and that was 7 days a week. So I came to this meeting for a long, long time, every Monday night. And I don't remember what it was like some of that time. I don't remember a lot of things from some of that time. I think I was almost wet-brained when I got here. One of the things I noticed coming to this meeting in the old days was I would listen to people tell their story, and when they finished telling their story, I would say, they were really drunk, and now they're not. And that's what I know about this guy. He was really messed up, or she, and they're not anymore, and they got to be better off than they were by coming to AA. I didn't know much about them. And also, I started telling my story when I was asked, because I was told by my sponsors, when they ask you to do something in AA, say yes. Don't ever say, I'm sorry, I'm busy, because you're not, and say yes. And so when they asked me to tell my story, I said yes. And I would tell my story extemporaneously, the way I'm speaking now. And then I got older, and I started to find that extemporaneous means I got to talking about something y'all weren't interested in at all, but I found eminently fascinating. And then we didn't get to finish the story. So I decided I would start telling my story from notes, and that's what I'm going to do tonight. And if you find that offensive, you can contact the people in New York, and they've got a form you can fill out. You have to do it online and send it off, and you can deal with it, you know. But anyway, I thought one of the things I also missed from some of the people that told their stories that I heard so many of in here was that I didn't know very much about them personally. So I thought I would preamble my AA story with some stuff about me just as a plain vanilla human being in this life. And so here's what it starts out with. I was born on the campus of the University of Texas, and this is still true. You can see the room I was born in from the back steps of the Texas Capitol building. It's the oldest building on the campus. No kidding. By the time I was 11 years old, I spent more than half my life in Puerto Rico. And I was an Army brat. That's what I was doing there. And I came home from Christmas my freshman year, saw a beautiful girl in a play. Freshman year in college, saw a beautiful girl in a play. And I said, wow. Wow. The next night, I was with a friend on the way to a movie. He said, I got to stop and say Merry Christmas to this girl. We went to her mom and dad's house. It was the same girl. And I said, this is a big deal. Things happening that you're not in charge of. You don't know what's going on. But I've been married to her now for 50 years. The first time they had an IQ test administered in the U.S., for people who could not read, would be little bitty kids. I took it at Mercer University. They also had it at Princeton University. These are weird things that happened in my life. I was a professional drinker. That is, I was not an amateur. I did not every now and then go to a bar and get drunk and go out and throw up in the parking lot. I drank professionally with an expense account every freaking day. And it was wonderful, and I loved it. And I know there's a lot of people in AA who drank and feel bad about it, that they didn't like it. It was bad to them, and they were bad to others, and they hate it. That is not my experience. If I could do it today, I would. And I know I can't, but I loved it. And I drank with a lot of cool people. I just want y'all to know a few of the people I drank with. I've had drinks with, these are all real, Julie Andrews, Richard Dreyfuss, William Windham, Joe Williams, Alex Hawkins, Jimmy Orr, Jimmy Carter, Sam Massell, Max Cleland, Ludlow Porch, David Schwartz, Helen O'Connell, that's an old one, Pat Conroy, Stuart Woods, Paul Hemphill, Dale Earnhardt, Sammy Davis Jr., Bill Mallard, Grayson Cookie Hamilton, Norris Herndon, John Huey, Al Brazelton, Zell Miller, when he was a Democrat, Manuel Maloof, and James Brown and his famous Flames. The whole band had drinks with them. Anyway, I love drinking, and I love drinking with people. So this is a deep sickness for me because it's like throughout everything in my life. I had a lot of experiences with people, and because of the business that I was in sales, a lot of great experiences, like the Atlanta Jazz Festival, and listening to Nina Simone and people like that, Dizzy Gillespie and Jimmy Smith, all those folks, Dr. John, and there's a lot of drinking and all that stuff, and it was all paid for by somebody else. It's so easy to do. So anyway, that's something about how I did my life. And this story starts, the drinking part of this story starts in 1962, which was the year I graduated from high school. I started college the next morning after I graduated. I could not wait to get out of my parents' house. I didn't know it then, but later on I figured it out. They didn't have any booze in their house. That was one reason I needed to get out of there. When I was a freshman in college, I fell in love with Kerry. And I fell in love with Scotch whiskey. And those two things happen within a few months of each other. It's amazing how things just thread together in your life. The civilization that we know, Western civilization, I understood from history, was held together by Irish monks during the Dark Ages. And I think Scotch whiskey held my life together the way they held civilization together, in very much the same way. I would have fallen apart without it. I really believe that. And that comes into the realm of the kind of spiritual paradoxes that you have, like you can't keep it unless you give it away. The life that you can have that's most abundant is the life you have when you give your life away for others. And things like you can't think your way into sober living, but you can live your way into sober thinking. And other things about spirits, like you one drink is too many, and a thousand is not enough. I went off to college, and I was a decent student most of the time, ABC, sometimes Dean's List, sometimes not. And I started at Piedmont College, and I was asked to leave by the president, not for good reason. We just had a disagreement. And so I went to the University of Georgia, changed majors, changed schools. And I had started selling liquor while I was at Piedmont. I mean, if you're selling liquor and you have a Foot Locker or two of liquor in your room, in your dorm, you don't ever run out of liquor. And you also don't run out of money because people won't have that. And we were in a dry county. And then when I moved to Athens, it was the same way. It was a dry county, too. And so some of the liquor I sold was non-tax paid. I stopped doing that when some boys at up in one of the high schools in Gainesville died from buying stuff from the guy I was buying my stuff from. So I stopped doing that. But I kept selling tax paid whiskey the whole time I was at Georgia. And we had a little shop we kind of set up in the trunk of the car behind the Chi-Fi house every Friday and Saturday night. And Dean Tate would stand around and talk to us while we sold liquor, and that was under the Boys Will Be Boys rule, that once you had it at a fraternity house, that the management of the university wouldn't do anything about it. But Dean Tate raided our room every Saturday morning at 9 o'clock the whole time I was at Georgia. And he never found the liquor. And after I graduated, I met him in downtown Atlanta one day, and he said, "Where would y'all have the liquor?" And I wouldn't tell him. And then I met his son after he died, and his son found out who I was, and he said, "Tell me, you never told my daddy, where'd y'all have the liquor?" That was his son after Dean Tate died. I was an Army brat, so I didn't get to stay in one place very long. Got to move around a lot, and that changes things for you. I envy now, sometimes I envy people that grew up in the same neighborhood, went to the same grammar school and the same high school that all their friends went to, and they're my age now, and they've got Facebook friends that are the same ancient age. That's a bourbon. And they still are in touch. They still hug each other when they see each other, and they hugged each other the first time when they were in the third grade or something like that. I don't have any people like that. I found it very hard to find the people that I grew up with because they're scattered everywhere, and I can't remember their names and that sort of thing. So, but it also makes you agile, makes it easy for you to deal with situations when you move every 3 years or sometimes in 2 years if a war breaks out and your dad has to run off. And that happened at least once when Korea came. And so there are things you have to adapt to. And I spent an afternoon one time talking with Pat Conroy, who wrote Prince of Tides and The Great Santini, and a lot of his stuff was about his dad. And we talked about dads for a whole afternoon. We drank while we were doing that, by the way. And we had a lot to share, but it wasn't matched up. His dad was a lot more of a hard ass than my dad was. My dad was, I really appreciated talking to him because Army brats have a problem, a lot of them, Navy brats, Air Force brats, with how the military was for them as a kid. And I'm not blaming anything about drinking on that, because I think if I'd lived in the most sedate and stable environment in the world, I still, once I found out how good whiskey was, I would have been exactly the same. So they didn't do it to me by being Army people. And along in the business of we talk all the time in AA about God, and we don't talk about theology, but we're just right at the edge of it, and we kind of do that dance about, let's don't piss anybody off, because, you know, a lot of people get pissed off when you start talking about God, because somebody did some God thing to them, and it hurt them, and I've seen that, and there's a lot of hurt people in the world about the God stuff, and it turns out after a while that kind of come to understand it's not God that's hurting people. It's some of his precious children don't know how to do it right or something, and they hurt somebody sometimes. But I had a hard time with the God thing when I was a little kid, because I thought the sin and punishment and redemption thing was really rigged against me. I always felt like I was two steps away from big trouble. Now I understand, if you're an alcoholic, you are always two steps away from big trouble. But when I was a kid, I thought, this deal's unfair. Of course, that helped me learn how to have resentments, and so I got a lot out of it, after all. I did stuff that I was that made me think everything was okay. I came into Atlanta out of University of Georgia. In my graduating class, I was in the, this is from a major professor, I was in the top 10% of wage earners starting out from the University of Georgia, not counting the guys that went to work for Daddy and women who went to work for Daddy. If you leave them out, it's in the top 10%. And I was in sales, in printing, in advertising, and publishing. Which meant that stuff y'all have seen on Mad Men, it's true. They're not puffing. It was a little wilder in New York City than it was in Atlanta, because this is the Bible Belt, and we have people here that pretend they don't drink. But it was wild and crazy, and we drank a lot, and that was what we're supposed to do. And we had monster expense accounts, and so when you spend a lot of money on clients, you didn't get fussed at for blowing cash. You got praised for spending all that time with our precious clients. And I thought that was wonderful. And so I did it better than anybody I knew. And I got more and more praise, and I made money and won awards and got prizes and all kind of wonderful things. And we also got invited to all the parties. When you call on high-profile people, you get invited to high-profile parties. And I had a tailor-made tuxedo. Also had a 30-inch waist. And that's a nice memory. And Carrie had her little black dress. And we just did a whole bunch of that stuff. I had a client at George Bauer who called me and Carrie the golden couple. And he didn't think he was being sarcastic. He thought he was being complimentary, and we thought so too. The thing about it was, it was vapid. It was shallow. It was all based on how you look, and it was all, and you know, it's what a lot of people call bullshit. That's what it was. But the thing about it is, it felt good at the time, and you got to be with everybody. Everybody got to be with you. You were connected with a whole lot of people, and they all knew each other. And moving around and that, and Atlanta, I got to meet some fantastic people. I mean, a whole bunch of those people I said I drank with were friends. I wasn't friends with James Brown and his famous flames. I don't mean that, but I was friends with an awful lot of those Atlanta people, and we broke bread. We got drunk. We spent a lot of quality time together, though. So there were some good things. It wasn't all bad. And some of those people had some tragic things happen with them, though. And won't go into all those. That's their stories. But the ones that are still alive to tell them. And that's another thing too. An awful lot of the folks that I drank with are dead, and some of them are dead because of alcohol. I had two different friends, several years apart, who died at the age of 54. Both of them were 54 when they died, about four, five, 6 years apart. Both of them died when their heart exploded. Now think about that. Alcohol etches the inside of your cardiovascular system, the way that artists use acid to etch glass, to put pretty pictures on glass. Alcohol does that to the inside of your vessels and arteries and in your heart. And if you drink enough, you can. That's just one of the things that can happen from alcohol. Then, as far as things happening to me from alcohol, We had, while all this was going on, we had two children. First we had Christopher, and 20 months later we had Patrick. Christopher survived my alcoholism. Patrick did not. If trouble could be found, Patrick could find it. He found it in the swimming pool one summer morning. We lived at Dorchester over by the Druid Hills Golf Club. It's condos now. It was apartments then. And he was in a near-death condition when a neighbor spotted him in the pool. And he died 7 days later after we accepted the reality of his condition and suspended heroic efforts on the part of hospital staff and physicians. And I don't know if many of you have had anything like that happen to you, but you don't ever get over it. You never do. And most couples who have a minor child die of anything other than a long-term illness, or it's like 98% of them get a divorce. You just can't deal with each other after that happens. And it's about six miracles that Carrie and I did not get a divorce. And I know good and damn well that if we had, I would have been dead in a very short time. Because she had a lot to do with why it took me longer than as long as it did to try to drink myself to death. So what happened with me when I kept drinking was in 1983, I was walking in the backyard one morning in our home over here in Brookhaven. We had a little vegetable plot out there. There's still enough grass and room and everything enough to play touch football with the kids, but we had room for a little garden too, and I was out looking at tomatoes and bell peppers and stuff like that, and all of a sudden I had a pain in my back that felt like somebody was chopping me with an axe. And I had no idea what the pain was, but I knew it was really bad enough that I think I'm going to die. And I was so terrified, Carrie was upstairs asleep Sunday morning early. And I went and got in the car and drove to DeKalb Medical. And when I got in there, they said, tell us what's going on. As soon as I told them, they knew what it was. And so they gave me a shot of morphine. And then they gave me another one a little while later when I wouldn't stop screaming. Then they gave me another one a little while later when I wouldn't stop screaming. And when they gave me the fourth shot, they said, "This is all we can give you because more than this will kill you. If this doesn't work, you're screwed." And it worked. So 2 days later, I woke up and the first thing I saw, this is really weird, was not my wife, was Carol Maloof, Robert Maloof's wife, Manuel's brother's wife. And Carol was looking in the room. She said, "He's awake." And I found out, and Carrie was sitting down, so I couldn't see her. Carol was standing up. She was tall. And I found out, and then the rest of the day, during the day, I talked to different doctors, kept coming in and telling me stuff. And the next day, Bill Hardcastle, who was the chief of surgery at DeKalb, came in and he said, "Your operation was the nastiest piece of work I have ever done in my life." And he said, "And I've done over 1,000 thoracic and abdominal surgeries." He said, "My chief nurse threw up in the OR. It was that bad. And I had pancreatitis and I had gangrene on the inside." And that was why it was so bad when they cut me open. It was like, oh, it killed all the other germs in the room, I'm sure. They said, when I was leaving the hospital, several MDs told me, they said, "If you drink again, you're going to get pancreatitis again, because you have insulted your pancreas and your liver so bad, you're not going to be able to live through this again." And I proved to them that they were wrong by drinking for 4 more years. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know how I was able to do that. But I took a 6 weeks break, went out of town on a business trip, sat down to lunch with a guy, and he said, "I need a drink." And I said, "Me too." And, by then, that was Columbia, South Carolina. 2 drinks on the way back to Atlanta that afternoon from Columbia, which is a 45-minute trip. And then stopped off at Colony Square, a familiar bar, as soon as I could get away from the airport and get into town. And then I was off and running for 4 more years. And when I got here, I had gone to, I'd gone to jails. Where I'd gone was, I was driving my 4-year-old VW Rabbit, which is a magnificent piece of engineering, and a guy in a brand new, we're talking about less than 48 hours old, 280Z, got in my way. The reason I'm so proud of the engineering on the Volkswagen is it wiped out the Z. Only did about $1,200 worth of damage to the Volkswagen. But anyway, that put me in jail. So rather than rush down there and get me the next day when they found out where I was, my wife and one of the priests at St. Bartholomew's showed up late in the afternoon. And I said, "Y'all took your time getting here." And so this priest says, "Well, we knew you weren't going anywhere, and we were busy." Kind of set things up for how people were going to relate to me now. And we got in the car, and we're driving back out to northeast Atlanta. And the priest says, "So when are you going to a meeting?" And I said, "Well, I guess I'll go right away." And I did that so she would not say anything else like that. I didn't want to hear it. And so I came home, tried to pull myself together, started seeing how bad things really were, because now I'm all of a sudden, even after a couple of days, I'm not drinking. And I know that things are bad. Things are really, really bad. And the marriage is falling apart. My son's is a freshman in college up at Berry, and I have no idea what's going on with him. And my career was in a washout mode. And so here I show up at NABBA, and I like to characterize it as I fell into the hands of angels when I got here. And those angels were Stan Parks and Gerald Daly. Stan's dead now. Is there a thing on here? they took me in. I asked them after I'd been here for several months if they would, both of them, be my sponsors. And Gerald just started laughing, and he said, "We've been sponsoring you since you got here." And then Stan said, "You dumb shit." And so they did it. And they did it right, I think. And what they did, Stan says, just don't drink and go to meetings. And do what we do. Just do what we do. Don't try to figure this out. Just do what we do. And I couldn't do anything else because I didn't know what was going on. And I found out that just this is what we did and this is what we got. And you can do this too if you really want to. We'll show you how. That's how it works in AA. And I didn't understand what was going on. I felt comfortable because they were kind of holding on to me. I was still terrified. And I heard this guy in the men's meeting, and he was sitting over there where that chap in the visor sitting, and his name was Harry. And Harry's out in Utah now. And I don't remember what Harry said, but he said something I understood. And I thought, wow, I'm going to get it. It's going to work. I can understand this. And Harry did not finish the eighth grade. Harry spent a whole lot of time in prison. Harry taught me about the egalitarian nature of AA, that it was for everybody, and everybody was the same here. We didn't have any special people here. We didn't have any royalty, and we didn't have any bums either. Everybody was the same here. And Harry taught me that. He also taught me, I love the way he used to say this, anytime two drunks get gut level honest with each other, God is there. And I believe it. That may be the only way to get God where you want him anyway, or her, whatever. But we took our time doing the steps. I kept saying, I want to go ahead and do my four step. I'm ready to do my four step. So we can do our fifth step together. Stan, Gerald. And Stan kept saying, nope. Gerald kept saying, nope. And I would just feel bad and keep muddling along. And finally I just said, you know, why won't you guys let me go ahead and do the four step so we can sit down and do the fifth step? And Stan said, because you're still lying to us. And I had become so like the life I was having for all those years, those 25 years of drinking, about being dishonest, that I did not know how to tell the truth more than 15 minutes in a row. It didn't matter what we were talking about. And so I had to get a consciousness about that. It wasn't easy. It was hard to do. I had learned to live and think a certain way, and it was really hard to live and think a different way. And finally they said I could go ahead, we could do that. And applying the principles in all my affairs. I know I've got friends in here who have been to more than one 12-step program. And I had to go to one that deals with money because I didn't have enough rigorous honesty about money to be able to manage financial affairs without screwing them up. But I did that, and Gerald sent me there. And it worked. It helped. And it made it better, and it made it different. And it's all better now. That kind of thing's not a problem anymore in my life. What happens after you've been sober more than 20 years? And some of the things that have happened to me is finding some things that I said when I was a very young person. This is what I want. When I was about 15, I said, I want to be a poet. I want to write poetry. I want to write words like some of these I've read. I had some great teachers. Had fantastic teachers in high school. One of my teachers in high school taught Carson McCullers, who was Carson Smith then, and wrote Member of the Wedding and that kind of thing. And they all thought she was going to be a concert pianist. They thought, well, she'd started out at Juilliard. But she was a better writer than she was a pianist. But she was taught by my high school English teacher for my junior and senior year. Had some other great teachers. And I'd read these poems, and I'd fall in love with these words. And I said, I have to do this. And I didn't do a poem that I thought was worth sharing with other people until I was 56 years old. And I'd been in here a pretty long time by then. Oh, it seemed like a long time anyway. And so since then, I've published two books of poetry, and I've got another one in the works right now. Everybody doesn't read them, but the people that do read them love them, which is what matters. Two of them have had music written for them and have been performed in churches. They're kind of religious. I know, you know, and I always say in AA, I'm not religious, I'm an Episcopalian. But that was something else that I got to do, too. I had sat in a pew or a chair or something at St. Bartholomew's for a bunch of years, since 1975. So I'd been sitting there for 12 years before I ever came to AA. And I had known they had something there that I wanted, just like you people had something I wanted. They had something I wanted, too. I had no idea what it was or how to get it, just like when I came in here. I didn't know what y'all had, and I didn't know how to get it. I thought maybe it was something I either needed or wanted. And I thought that about St. Bartholomew's as well. Not necessarily the entire church, the whole church, or the whole Episcopal church, but just that one. And so I found out that I was able to be useful in that and get involved in things in the diocese and do stuff. And it has been very rewarding. And the parts of the big book that I love the best are the parts that show me the stuff that I had handed to me on a silver platter in my life that I ruined, that I screwed up, that I drunk up. I can have things that nice again. I can have a life outside of alcohol, and it can involve other people. And it can be rich, and it can be rewarding, and it can be a blessing to them and to me too. And I've been able to do that because I've been sober. And I got that way here. And Stan used to say, if you do what we did, you'll get what we got. Somebody else says that too, I think. We worked in the same, I'm almost finished. We worked in the same company for about a year, same printing company, and Stan was the chief estimator for all their printing jobs, and I was in sales there. And this was towards the end of my corporate life, but I went into Stan's office one day, and everybody was welcome, and he never had the door closed. And on his desk was a big book, a bottle of vodka, a pint, not enough, you know, to really enjoy yourself, but a pint, and a pistol. And this is a place of business. This is a place that's got a board of directors and a CEO and all that stuff. I said, Stan, for God's sakes, you've got a pistol on your desk. And I knew he wasn't drinking the vodka, so I didn't know what that was about. I knew what the big book was, but there's a pistol. He said, I just had a guy come in here who doesn't know if he wants to stay sober or not. And he said, I keep that shit in the drawer for this kind of occasion. He said, when he started whining to me, he didn't know if he wanted to stay sober or not. I said, you've got three choices. You can get sober, you can get drunk, or you can kill yourself. And he said, I don't know how to make that decision. So I pulled out the pistol, I pulled out the big book, and I pulled out the bottle and put them on the desk and said, make a decision with that. The guy picked the big book. I said, how many times have you done this, Stan? He said, a bunch of times. They always pick the big book. I asked him if the gun was loaded. He said, of course the gun's loaded. It wouldn't have any value if the gun were not loaded. That's how I understand AA. This deal's, it's loaded. You know, it's there. I told y'all at the beginning, I really love whiskey. And I really love all the stuff that went with that. I really did. I didn't love the pain and suffering that I caused to other people and that I caused to myself. But the front end of the deal, I really loved. But I know from all that I've seen since I've been here, I know how easy it would be for me to say, I want to do that again just one more time. But I also know the absolute terror and destruction that that brings. And I don't want it. And you all taught me how to not want it. And I appreciate that. That's it.
Thank you, Ken, very much for being here tonight, sharing your experience, faith, and hope with us.
gonna happen in this old town? But I know there's gonna be trouble when my mouth turns dry. Stay away from danger. Been that way since I was a child. Drink it to death.